The following presentation was recorded in 1998 at the Faith Builders Workshops on Child Development. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Start out a bit on the light side this morning. Good old Charlie Brown. Now, you know, before you read all this, you know, one of the most common pictures I remember of Charlie Brown is him trying to catch a ball on pitcher's mound and landing flat on his back, you know, missing the ball, or he managed to catch it. He's not really the athletic type. So he's walking along with Lucy here, and he says, and she's saying, you know, a princess sort of thing, a white dress and nice slippers in a big ballroom. And Charlie says, uh-huh. But I guess that's kind of silly, isn't it, Charlie Brown? No. Oh, no, not at all. I mean, well, we all have our little daydreams or ambitions or whatever you want to call them. I mean, there's one I've had myself for years, but I've never told anyone. What, Charlie Brown? You can tell me. Oh, no, it's not the sort of thing I should tell. No, I don't think I should. Oh, come on. I wouldn't give it away. Come on. Please. Well, I've always wanted to be called Flash. I hate the name Charlie. I'd like to be real athletic and have everybody call me Flash. This is written back in 1963. I'd like to be so good at everything that all around school I'd be known as Flash. And hey, Violet, listen to this. Flash? Poor Charlie Brown. I can't stand it. Well, we laugh. And it's a good thing that he's on paper. But you know, there's a lot more truth to that than we'd like to admit. How many times in grade school did you do something similar? And I wonder if it was ever done to you, do you still remember it? And then, of course, I'd like to ask why you still remember it. There's a good reason. Well, I have these little reading stories that I keep that I've pulled out over the over the years. I haven't taught that long, but over the years that I have been teaching. And I'd like to read another one to you this morning. And, you know, I often think about this in the summer or on some weekend or at some teacher workshop when I read or hear a great story. Someone has taken the time to write about a teacher and a student. And if you're like me at all, you're just idealistic enough, just maybe perfectionistic enough to want that sort of thing to happen in your classroom. And you wonder just exactly how it is that this was able to happen for this teacher. And probably, if we're honest, at some level we would like to have great things happen in our classroom. And I like this story because it again suggests that great things seldom happen unless there have been some great sacrifices on your part. Notice, great things happen through Jesus Christ, but of course there was a crucifixion, you know. And I like to just suggest that sometimes it requires the same thing for us. Things that feel like crucifixions often come before resurrections or ascensions. This article is titled, One Wrinkled Note. Daniel was cute as a button. He was also hyperactive. He was big for his age, but he was also what many would call slow. He was quick enough to know he was different, but he was not quick enough to compensate for the ways in which he was different. Daniel had made it through preschool and 1 year of kindergarten without anyone really taking the time to find out why he was different. He was a little uncoordinated, but so are many other young children, especially boys, who are a little big for their age. He hated working with letters and numbers, but so do many other normal children. It was decided that Daniel would spend an extra year in kindergarten. Probably another year would give him the time he needed to catch up in the areas in which he lagged behind. But another year did not help Daniel. He still could not recognize the letters of the alphabet. Learning their sounds was like learning a foreign language. Writing letters and numbers was impossible, and getting along with others was becoming a great big problem. The school board met to discuss Daniel's future. The big question was, should Daniel be allowed to remain at school? There was not a lack of compassion. The question was whether or not the school could meet Daniel's needs. Daniel's mother, a single parent, was very concerned. There were excellent schools in the area for meeting the needs of special children, but none of them were Christian schools, and she wanted her son to receive a Christian education. Finally, a decision was reached. Daniel would be given one more chance. He would be tested by specialists, and he would be placed under the hand of an experienced teacher who seemed to have a knack for reaching and teaching unteachable children. If Daniel could begin to learn to read over the summer, he would be allowed to continue at the school in a special program for the learning disabled. Daniel was tested. His problem was diagnosed as midline brain damage. The prognosis was not all that hopeful. He probably could learn to read, but it would probably take years. He was given only 3 months, remember. He would probably someday be able to pass his driver's test and fill out application forms, but he might never be able to read and comprehend the local newspaper. He would probably never be able to acquire a high school diploma. The teacher was willing to take on the challenge. She was not trained to help children with Daniel's problems, but she knew where to begin by seeking the one who knows all things and who freely gives wisdom to those who ask. The challenge was a tough one. At times, teaching Daniel to read seemed an impossible dream. But little by little, things started to click in Daniel's mind. Progress was slow at first, but in time, he confused the letters less often. A desire to learn began to grasp his heart. He worked so hard, he would often break out in a sweat. By the end of the summer, a pattern of learning was beginning to take shape, and a miracle blossomed. Daniel knew his letters and sounds, and he could read three-letter words. Daniel could continue his education at the Christian school. The teacher wrote down all the details of the program she had developed for Daniel, and she turned it into the head of the LD program. LD is learning disabled. She spent hours with the LD teacher, teaching her how to teach Daniel. She wrote up his individual program for the year, and she thanked God for helping her help this precious little lamb. Daniel had a good school year. He could read, and he was so much happier. Instead of terrorizing the other children, he had a few friends now. He even enjoyed being hugged, something he had before avoided like the plague. The changes in his behavior and performance were a joy to everyone who knew him. At the end of the year, at a closing faculty meeting, the miracle of Daniel's year was shared with the faculty, but a most disturbing thing happened. The credit was given to the LD teacher, not to the Lord to whom the honor belonged, not to the teacher to whom the Lord revealed the program which made things click. No, the glory went to a teacher and an administrator who had recommended that Daniel not even be given that one more chance. The teacher sat very still in her chair, watching others get words of congratulations and pats on the back. Later that day, she returned to her own classroom. The walls were empty. The books were packed away. There was only one more thing to do before summer vacation could begin: clean out her desk. She was just about finished when she saw a wrinkled piece of paper stuck in the corner of a drawer. Carefully, she pulled it out from its hiding place and opened it up. Four words were scribbled on the paper. Each letter was written in a different crayon color. The words said, I love you. A name was carefully printed underneath the message. It had been painstakingly written, probably sweated over. The teacher knew then that the faculty meeting recognition didn't matter. A child had been helped. He had felt loved, and he now felt free to love. A heart had been touched. A miracle had happened. God knew all about it, and that's all that mattered. I get a daily update in my email from a friend. A lot of you probably know about the situation, Tanya Lefevre. How many of you know Tanya? A few of you do. I just got a note again this morning, and Tanya was in an accident, and end of May, I believe, and had significant head injuries. Still not conversing. She was a very bright lady, and it's really difficult to see her in this kind of condition because she's not able to communicate. They don't know how much she knows, how much she recognizes. And they're at the point where they need to make some decisions about what kind of rehab to put her into. And I thought this morning maybe we could just pause for prayer and just ask that God could give wisdom to the family. She was just married last fall, and so you can imagine this has put quite a strain on her husband, and he's been very committed to caring for her, even though there's nobody knows for sure just how much recovery there will be. So they really do need our prayers, and I'd like if we could just stop and pray together this morning. Lord, this morning, as we think about our calling as teachers, I pray, Father, that you would anoint us. Father, help us to be willing to go for the long haul, to be willing to go for what we know is right and good and whole for children without regard to our own reputation, the praise we receive from others. It's difficult, Lord, to minister to children, especially sacrificially, and not really get hung up on how much recognition we get or how much feedback or love from even the students. Lord, I pray that you would enable us to walk with you and to minister in the power and strength of your presence this next school year. And Lord, to know the same leadership, the same sacrifice, the same love that you had for people. Lord, I lift up Tanya this morning. And Lord, we our minds strain to begin to comprehend the whys, the what ifs. Father, I pray that you would help us in the midst of all that confusion and questioning. Lord, help us to move toward you and to trust you when it seems ridiculous and somehow ludicrous to even trust, to understand. Lord, I pray that you bring healing to Tanya. We lift her up to you. I pray that you continue restoring her. I also pray that you be with Roy and her family. Give them wisdom and direction, insight. I pray that you would lead them and hold them in the palm of your hand as they go through each day. I pray they would know you. Being our time together this morning, we lift you up and honor you. I pray that you would instill in us a spark, Lord, for people, and a heart for what is on your heart. And I pray all this in Jesus' name. Amen. I was just thinking last night, pondering some of the things we talked about yesterday, and just realized again, you know, that the older I get, and I'm only mid-30s, but the older I get, I realize how much I continue to grow in my understanding and my love for children, and how much I have just insensitively overlooked at times as I relate to children. And I just pray that God would continue to reveal to me what he meant in those two scriptures when he says, except you become as a child. And then as well, the verse that says that if you offend a little one, it'd be better if a millstone hung around your neck. Some powerful words in those two passages. A few quotes. Children do not know that their parents love them, and they never will, till the grave closes over those parents, or till they have children of their own. Charles Dickens. I love these little people. And it is not a slight thing when they, who are so fresh from God, love us. Every child comes with the message that God is not yet discouraged with men. A little quote here, a statistic. Where's Dad? A survey report in the Wall Street Journal found that out of 100 CEOs, 85 say they would like more family time, but only 7 said they actually expect to make it happen. Just remind you again that part of the work of Christ was to come to turn the hearts of fathers back to their children. And it's no surprise, if you look at crime in America today, who commits crime? Most crime is committed by males. You look at every major issue. And you'll find generally that there is an out-of-control man. Now, I want to hasten to say it doesn't mean that women aren't evil at times. But somehow, I like how I heard it described one time that a man has tremendous potential to bless or to hurt. And it's a little bit like, I don't know if you've ever taken your children to the fire station on a field trip, and the firemen explain how this fire hose, and they ask the children, so how many men do you think it takes to hang on to this fire hose if all the water, you know, it's a canvas hose about like that. And of course they have fun guessing, and it takes at least 2, sometimes 4 men to control the end of that hose when it's blasting water out full power. And when a man is not in, has not submitted his life to the Lord, and he's bouncing off the walls of life, you might say, it's just like someone on the end of a fire hose by himself, instead of with the help of other men. He's hanging on this hose, and this hose has, you know, water spewing out, supposed to be this blessing, right? Puts out a fire, saves things, stops fires. But instead, he's banging around, flailing people in his life, damaging, hurting. What would be potential to bless is only damaging. And so, tremendously important, especially as men, that we give serious attention to what God has called us to be. Let's talk some more about some of the needs that children have. We left off yesterday talking about security, and I want to begin today These are a little bigger. And they'll get bigger as we go here. But let's think about acceptance. Accepting a child for who they are. Of course, we're going to talk some more about discipline, so I'm not speaking about this subject divorced from the area of discipline and other things that children need. But let's just think about acceptance by itself here for a minute. Too many of us convey the idea to a child that they are accepted when they succeed, but are not accepted when they fail. And it's so easy to do this. As soon as they fail at something, it's either here, let me show you how to do that, or here, you didn't do that right, let me show you how to do it right. Or if they're not as good at something as what we would like, we're quick to apologize to other people for our children when they don't perform quite like we think they should. And so when my children are in another, are with other people, what kind of corrective measures do I take when I'm in public with my children compared to the measures I take when I'm at home? I might be much quicker in public to correct simply because I want people around me to think that my children, you know, behave well. But when I'm at home, I may overlook it. And children are smart enough that given enough years of that, they sense that. They know the difference. And it's an acceptance issue. Sometimes accepting children and other times depreciating them causes children to see themselves with a mixture of respect and scorn. It's the person who doesn't know how to control the anger or perhaps enjoys using sarcasm or laughing at children, may not think about it being that terrible, but if there is a mixture of acceptance and scorn, again, the child, you may think, well, I at least I tell them often enough. But on an extreme scale, it's the parent who, in anger, is abusive, physically abusive, or even verbally abusive. And then other times, just extremely affectionate. It's a mixed signal to a child. They can't decipher. They never know if the parent is going to hit or hug. It's Frank Sinatra that said that his mother was an extremely volatile-tempered person, and that whenever she said, come here, he never knew if he was going to get hit or hugged. Never knew which it was going to be. Well, it's a profound impact on a child. Children who do not feel accepted by parents become vulnerable to destructive group pressure. They fight for acceptance from others and are also likely to feel that God hates them. Or at least they feel they can't perform enough, well enough to please God. I knew one parent who said that he looks for opportunities. As his children were growing up, he looks for opportunities for them to stand up against peer pressure. While that sounds like a good idea on its face, except that he did not provide the warmth and security and the stability in his own home to give them the internal fortitude to feel good about doing what was right and helping the child stand up against peer pressure. You know what? Those children grew up to be more sensitive to peer pressure than many of their peers whose parents did not necessarily voice that kind of goal for their children. It's important that acceptance is underneath that, because children will find acceptance somewhere. Acceptance and a sense of usefulness are what comprise emotional health. Acceptance and a sense of usefulness, that relates to what we talked about yesterday about praising for actual achievement. What builds Let's see here. What am I? Okay. Why do children feel a lack of acceptance? Well, several reasons. Constant criticism creates feelings of failure, rejection, and inadequacy. We talked about this yesterday. Some of these overlap. We won't spend a lot of time on these. Comparing children with others. That says, I don't accept you as you are. Expecting children to achieve their parents' unfulfilled dreams causes them to feel unaccepted. One father told his son, you know, he says, in many ways, I see you as a Solomon. You're doing things that I was never able to do. That's different than saying, all the time as a child is growing up, saying, you know, you have to get A's. You've got to get A's. I never had a chance in school like you did, and I fully intend that you do well in school. A little different than saying that. Some of that encouragement, if it's done in the right context, can be great. But be careful that you don't force the child just to fulfill your dreams that you were never able to experience. It's a little bit like the parent who says, I grew up in poverty, my children will not grow up in poverty. So their children have everything they could possibly want. And you know the story. That happens. They haven't really done the child a favor. Overprotecting children. Again, we think we want to be so careful and we're just going to protect the child. It's impossible to protect someone completely from pain. Better a broken bone, someone has said, than a broken spirit. Expecting too much of children. This again has to do with number three. Parent wants a model child, and they're all anxious about that all the time. The child must be perfect. Well, what builds a sense of acceptance? How can I build into this child's life a sense of acceptance? Well, I can recognize children as unique. I can teach them to share in the joy of each other's gifts. Now, one of the things that's easy to do, our oldest is 9 and the second one is 5. So there's 4 years in between there. And it's easy for them, especially for the second one, he thinks he has to do everything the first one does. He has to keep up. He's got to have every opportunity, every chance. Well, somehow we have to learn to help him enjoy the fact that the oldest, that Patrick can do certain things that he can't. And he has to rejoice. It's like the Bible talks about rejoicing those with those that rejoice, weep with those that weep. And that builds a sense of acceptance. Help children find satisfaction and achievements, working with them. Children find tremendous satisfaction in working with a teacher or a parent, being able to accomplish something. Let children know you love them, want them, and really enjoy them. And I just wrote myself a note here so I don't forget to tell you this little story. Verbalizing can be difficult if you're not used to it. I knew when I got married that if I wanted to communicate love to my children, I was going to have a difficult time. I talked about that a little bit yesterday. And so I heard someone say one time that he had the same problems. He decided that from the first day he had a baby, a child, he was going to start saying, I love you, right from the start. It wasn't going to wait until the child was 3 or 5 or 10 to start trying to say, I love you, because he knew he'd never be able to pull it off. And so from the first day that child was home, he'd put him to sleep, he'd pick him up, and he'd cuddle and hold, and he'd tell this little baby, I love you. Well, I had not yet had my first child, but when I had my first child, you know, babies are easy to love, especially if they're fairly content. We just love to hold and snuggle babies. You know, along about 6 months into this, I realized as this child began responding and smiling and cooing and responding facially to attention, I started to feel this slow buildup within me. You know, I should start expressing things to this child. This sounds crazy to you, but you know what? It took me a while to actually say to this little six-month baby, I love you. To look this little baby in the eyes and say that. He didn't have a clue what I was saying, except maybe he read my face and heard it. But I began to practice. Every night I said this. And I just kept doing it every night until it became easy, until it felt natural. Didn't feel natural at all at first. It felt stilted. Didn't feel very, very natural. But I just kept doing this. And you know, what makes it worth it is the first time that child says spontaneously, hey, Dad, I love you. Where did he learn that? Well, we need to accept children's friends. The home needs to be a place where they can freely bring their friends. Number five, maintain an honest, genuine relationship with children. And this is difficult for me, too, at times, has been more. But I've seen people try to relate to children and they pour. Gush, I call it. Just pour on. It's not an honest, genuine relationship. You have to be you. It's the same thing we talk about in children's literature. A good children's book is enjoyed by adults as well as children. You ever notice that? You can read a children's book and adults will often listen in. It's fun. That same quality is true in relationships. It has to be an honest, genuine relationship. You can't demand perfection. Confess your own failures, admit your mistakes, even laugh at them. Listen to what they say. Love is spelled T-I-M-E. Treat children as persons of worth. Courtesy should be normal. You know, it's amazing what a child will do when he's taught, when mom and dad say, thank you, you're welcome, please, excuse me. It's amazing how spontaneous children are with those same things. When mom and dad, as a matter of course, don't just push the child out of the way to walk through the room. They don't just assume the child will do things. A friend of mine who was in quite a bit of counseling was relating an incident with a lady she meets with who was nearly the youngest of a large family, had more than a dozen children. And she was one of the last children. I'm not saying big families are bad when I say this. Yet this girl would go out in the barn and hide, just spend hours in the barn in hiding because she just felt, she grew up feeling she was just always in the way. Just always in the way. Never felt like she was wanted or desired or enjoyed by her family, but would just And actually acted out on that by going out and being in the barn. And no one asked her, well, where were you? Or why were you out in the barn? No one really particularly cared as long as she was out of the way. And my friend had said that here nearly a year ago, as this girl had been telling her story, one particular time they met, she had given her a hug just to let her know that, hey, I do care about your, I want to hear your story. I want to know about you, and I just want to give you a hug. And a year later, this lady that she was counseling brought it up and said, you know, you don't know how much that meant to me to have you give me a hug. I don't ever remember being hugged by anyone after I was, you know, a young child. We cannot underestimate the power of respect and love. Allow children to grow and develop in their own unique way. It's amazing. My third son, he is just not athletic at all. The first two, they love to play ball. They've been playing ball for, you know, ever since they could manage to hang on to one. But, you know, he is over three years old. He still cannot throw a ball overhand. You tell him to throw, and he watches his brothers play all the time. You tell him to throw a ball, he gets it out there, and he kind of lobs it. And it's amazing. My youngest, who's only a little over a year, he's already throwing objects this way. You know, he's not very accurate, but he's throwing objects. My three-year-old is still doing this number, you know. Children are all different. They're unique. Remember, as the child feels acceptance from you, only then does he or she feel accepted by others and God. And that really is critical. The child experiences fundamental acceptance. They feel it from God and others. Well, a fourth need of children. Children need to love and be loved. What is this need to love and be loved? Ask parents if they love their children, and they'll tell you, of course I love my children. But the more important question is, do your children know they are loved? Do your children know they are loved? That's the more important question. Of course a parent is going to say, I love my child. But ask the child, do you know you are loved? Now, I saw this when I had parent-teacher conferences. All these parents would come in, Dad, he's driving local truck route. He's gone from 3 in the morning till 8 o'clock at night. Driving his truck. He's so busy, you know, and he's friendly and he talks. And, yeah, the children, you know, and he... Nice guy. Nice guy. But his son, a senior in high school, will sit there. He's a big guy. Over 6 feet. Must have weighed... I never asked him, but he wasn't fat. He just must have weighed 225, 250 pounds. I don't know. He was a big boy. A lot bigger than I was. He was like, hi, how are you doing? You know, make sure you sit in that chair. Well, but his son would sit there and cry and say, you know, I don't know if my, I can't talk to my dad about things. And so we'd talk about what kinds of things that men struggle with, and we would share, and he would share his struggles. And but you know, Dad, I said, what would happen if you'd say, hey, Dad, you know, can we talk? Can we just go for a walk or go for ice cream or something? Can we talk? And boy, he shakes his head. I don't know if I can do that or not. Well, you know, inside I'm angry. I'm telling the wrong person, you know, to initiate a relationship. It should be Dad that's initiating a relationship, but it's not. A year out of high school, this guy gets married to a lady that I guess I'll say it, an Amish girl. And this isn't a cast on the Amish. I know good Amish people. I have relatives who are Amish. But I think we know some of those things they struggle with their young people. And married this gal. You know, it's kind of a generalization, but they didn't have a clue, you know? They didn't have a clue. Life, I guess time will tell how that goes. But, you know, the interesting thing was he always felt nobody liked him. Always felt like a misfit. Never fit. Well, what happens when a child does not feel love? Here's a little poem entitled Doors by Herman. I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name. Hagedorn. Like a young child who to his mother's door runs eager for the welcoming embrace, and finds that door shut, and with troubled face calls, and through sobbing calls, o'er and o'er, calling. Storms at the panel. So before a door that will not open, sick and numb, I listen for a word that will not come. And know, at last, I may not enter more. Silence. And through the silence and the dark, that closed door, the distant sob of tears beats on my spirit, as on fairy shores, the spectral sea. And through the sobbing, hark! Down the fair-chambered corridor of years, the quiet shutting, one by one, of doors. Isn't that what happens when a child does not receive love from the most significant people? They shut doors. They shut the doors in their own lives. And no one else is able to get in that door. They can't push the door open. Well-adjusted versus deviant. Like I said yesterday, a child who has seen mom and dad love each other and who knows what it means to be loved seldom ends up in a probation officer's office. Love is a learned response. We learn to love. And that's what I meant a minute ago when I talked about telling my baby I love you until I learned to say it and it felt natural. Children are born with a great capacity to love, but without knowing how. That's why they need to feel it and experience it from us. And that's why that child who seems hard, you ever seen that child in your classroom? They just seem hard. You can't imagine hugging that child. A child needs to feel love, and you need to go the extra mile and be willing to experience some rejection from that child in order to teach them how to love. I was amazed when I began teaching 1 year, and I was new to this school. And the first week, I had one or two students tell me that I'm the best teacher they ever had. Isn't that amazing? Now, what made them think that? In the first week or 2 weeks of school, I'm the best one they ever had. Well, they must have felt something, and it was love. And these were students that were not easy for me to love. I could not tell them, you're the best student I ever had. Love must be spoken. Loving involves all of life, verbal and nonverbal communication. I love you. I don't know how, I guess we got started trying to sing Jesus Love You in sign language one time with my family. But the sign language for I love you is this. You know sign language, you know that. And that's just kind of become a tradition with our family. Whenever somebody's going somewhere, it's, hey, see you later. And the last wave is usually this, you know. But loving involves all of life, verbal and nonverbal communication. I love you. Practice saying it. Start early. F, love calls for action. Little girl who said, Mommy says she loves me, but she doesn't have any time for me. I had a middle-aged man, my church back home, was telling me about his teenage sons, and he was taking them, he was a hunter, fisherman type. And his sons just really loved to go fishing and hunting. And one night after work, his son said, hey, Dad, let's go fishing tonight. And I have their names here. I don't know if you know them or not. But Gilbert, he told me, he said, you know, Brandon, I just didn't feel like going fishing. It's the last thing I wanted to do. And I said, oh, well, yeah, let's not do it tonight. It's not like he never did, but that night he didn't feel like doing it. And a few minutes later, son said, Dad, I just feel like you're putting me off. This is his 18-year-old son. Dad, I just feel like you're putting me off. You just don't want to be around me. So he said, I told him, okay, let's go. We're going fishing. And he said, you know, we didn't do a whole lot of fishing. We sat out there in a boat and talked all evening, you know. And that's one thing that seems to be typical of parenting, and I think of truly great teaching, is that it goes the extra mile, calls for action. It has to be seen and felt. Love involves trust. I've known high school students who said, "Mom and Dad, they don't trust me to do anything." And they had to know everything. I'm not saying parents shouldn't know, but it was needing to know in a way that seldom allowed for any trust. It felt invasive. Love requires a willingness to listen. And I find this out, I can be sitting there reading or doing something, and when one of my boys says, Dad, I say, "Yeah, what do you want?" But I never look up. They don't hear what I say. I say, "Yeah, I'm listening. Go ahead." Dad. Okay. So I turn and look them in the eye. Then they're ready to talk. Do I feel like listening? Not usually. Love means sharing experiences. We'd like to be able just to say it and walk away, but it's not that easy. Love builds open and comfortable relationships. Children live by love, not food, shelter, or clothing. Of course, we need those, but you've all heard the stories of studies, babies that aren't shown love. Many of them die. It's a pretty callous experiment. But that's what happened. Love recognizes persons as more important than things. And we talked about that yesterday. Well, a fifth need for children is a need for praise. Children are hungry for praise. You praise a child, that child will come back to you again and again. And if they're a young child, they'll often tell you, "Hey, guess what I did? I did this. You know what I did for my mom? Do you know what I did for so-and-so?" What are they asking for? They're asking for praise, recognition. William James has said, "The deepest principle in human nature is the craving to be appreciated." Well, what are some guidelines for giving praise? Number one, praise performance, not their personality. Praise performance. Now, how do you balance this with what we said earlier about helping a child feel accepted and only helping them feel accepted when they do something right or do something well? Here, what we're talking about is praising issues that relate to character, initiative, kindness, consideration, thoughtfulness. Those are the kinds of things that we need to find and praise, rather than saying, "You are so cute. You are so good looking. You are so attractive," whatever else. Those are God-given traits. They do not have any control over those things. So praising those things at the expense of character issues can be damaging. Praise what children are responsible for rather than that which they cannot help. That's just what I got done talking about. Recognize that praise is especially needed from people who are important to a child. Like I said, children will go somewhere for acceptance, and they'll go somewhere where people tell them that they're okay, that they do something well. And if it's not us, they'll go find somebody else. One thing that's always sobering to me, I'll just be real honest, I want to be a hero for my boys. Of course, the oldest one's 9. I don't know if I'll be one or not. I hope I am. But I do know one thing, I don't want other people to be heroes at the expense of me being one. I sure hope they have others besides me, but I want to be one of those. Praise sincerely. Children sense fake very quickly. Praise children for what they do on their own initiative. Keep in mind that the sooner praise comes, the better. If you decide that you're going to wait till you see a certain behavior 3 times before you praise them, because you don't want to make them too proud or too self-conscious about that, you're taking the wrong approach. When you always praise. When you see good behavior, thank you, even a simple thank you is a form of praise. But when you see good behavior, latch on to it and praise it. Remember that parents' attitudes are just as important as their words in giving encouragement. And that is important. I think we'll stop and take a break at this point. And come back and finish that and then talk about theories and important people in child development. And I'm going to ask you to be back in here at 10:05. The need is discipline. And we're going to talk about this more on Friday in relation to classroom discipline. Just a few thoughts on it here. Obviously, it requires wisdom, patience, and persistence. And I want to say right up front here that I would add, it takes personal character on your own part. I don't know of anyone that can discipline well that doesn't have a strong sense of right and wrong, acceptable and unacceptable, and a willingness to see to it that it happens. Wisdom, patience, and persistence. And of course, then I've seen people who are very good. They have a strong sense of what's right and wrong, what's acceptable, unacceptable, but they don't do well at communicating it to students in a way that feels good to students. Not that all discipline will feel good, but it will feel right. It will feel respectful. It will feel relational, if I can use that word. So discipline reflects a lot on who you are. To say that love is all that is needed to be a good parent is like saying that love is all that is needed for a successful marriage. Nearly all divorced persons will admit they love their partner at one time. I have an uncle who's been married and divorced. He's been married 3 times, divorced twice. It was interesting. We were together as a family last winter for my grandfather's funeral. Would be his first wife's father. And he was there. He was my favorite uncle growing up. At least on that side of the family. But he was uncle-in-law. But it was interesting. I watched him that day, the evening and the next day, different activities around the funeral there. And at one point, he and my aunt, his first wife, just in the milling of the crowd of people, happened to get fairly close. And I saw them become very aware of how close they were to the other person. I was just standing there watching this. He would glance every now and then. She was only 2 or 3 feet away. That was painful to watch. And I talked to him later. And, then it was interesting. Her husband then immediately came over. She took his hand. It was nauseating. I talked to him later, and he says, "Yeah." I said, "Did you see that?" "Yeah." He starts talking about it. And I realized, that marriage isn't dead at all. It's not dead at all. It takes more than love for a successful marriage. Drescher gives a story in his book that we're resourcing here for this, about a teacher who puts a goldfish in a fishbowl without any stones, and the fish just kind of stayed right in the middle of the bowl and just kind of bunched right there. So she put stones in the bottom of the fishbowl, and immediately the fish swam around. He suddenly had a point of reference. Discipline is the same way. If there's no boundaries, seems children will go to no ends to find boundaries. And when there are none, I've seen children just go ballistic, spastic. Effective parents usually have certain qualities, and we're just going to name two. And I would say that this is true of teachers as well. An ability to accept the child warmly. And then they have consistent parenting behavior. Those two things, effective parents and effective teachers. Consistency. And this is what I'm talking about on the character issue. This is consistency in my mind is almost completely an issue of character. Because it is so difficult. I'm speaking from my own experience. At least for me, it is difficult to be consistent. It's a character issue. And it just requires some real self-sacrifice, doing things when you don't feel like doing it. Well, let's look at the last and final need that we're going to talk about here in this context. Needs that children have. A need for God. And just a couple things. The Bible doesn't say a whole lot about, does not say a whole lot about how children are to be instructed and taught in detail. It doesn't give a lot of detail. It doesn't say, you know, if you'll just take an hour every morning with your family and you teach them these five things. After they learn this, then you teach them this. It doesn't give you anything like that. But it does give us some broad categories. And one of the primary ones is that parents should be right with God themselves. And we could add teachers should be right with God themselves. You know, someone has asked, well, how can I make the Word of God sweet and powerful to my students? Did you ever pull out the Bible and kind of see your students go half asleep? You just kind of see the eyes glaze over. They know what's coming. And the unspoken look is, I already know everything you're going to tell me. Right? This is at least true in high school. I don't know if you've seen this, but I already know everything you're going to tell me, so what are you going to tell me today? And you can just kind of see it. And the only way to make the Scripture sweet and powerful is that it's sweet and powerful in your life, that it's new, it's relevant, it's the basis from which you operate. And God said of Abraham, I'm going to bless this man. I'm going to create of him a nation because he will command his children after him. Isn't that interesting? God saw that in Abraham. He will command his children after him. Maybe that's what it's all about. It's you having a relationship with the Lord, and then it's commanding your children after you. The Bible, secondly, puts the responsibility for religious training of children squarely on the parents. Squarely on parents. And as a teacher, you can never usurp the role of a parent. And you're going to find some parents doing a pretty lousy job. If your school is normal school, any size, I almost guarantee you you're going to find at least one family that's not doing real well. Parents aren't doing real well. But you know what? That does not remove the responsibility they have for their child. And so your job is to equip and to spark and motivate and encourage and challenge that parent all you can. And it takes the grace of God to do that in a way that's respectful, that's not belittling, that's not condemning, judging, critical, because those people are going to be very sensitive to that. They probably already know they're not doing a very good job. But the Bible always puts the responsibility for training on the parents, and the school should never usurp the home. Richard Baxter, a couple hundred years ago now, tells of coming into a community as a pastor and struggling and praying and preaching to bring revival to this church. It was a cold church. And one day he was on his face crying out to God for something. God, you've got to do something to wake these people up. And he felt impressed to begin working with families. He felt like God was telling him, you know, you're trying to do this through the church. He says, why don't you do this? Why don't you disciple family? So he began going from home to home and began teaching them how to have family Bible reading and family prayer and equipping dads and moms to teach children. And he says, over the next several years, revival began coming into that little town. Puts the responsibility directly on parents. Psalm 78 says a lot about this. In the first 8 verses, give the reasons for instruction. We won't read them here. But you read those verses. Psalm 78 is known as the educator's psalm. And you ought to become familiar with it. But it says 3 things about the purpose of instruction in Psalm 78, verses 1 to 8. Number 1, so children also put their faith in God. That's the purpose. So children also put their faith in God. That's what we're doing. You know, the popular notion today is that you need to give your children, you need to present them with all the options. Present them with all the options so they know, and then they can choose for themselves. And you know, humanly speaking, doesn't that make sense? I mean, humanly speaking, we would think, well, show them the options. I mean, there's different ways to go about this, you know. And yet, I always felt that I was just kind of forcing my, I would be forcing my children to believe a certain way. And I wanted them to choose. But Psalm 78 says that we instruct so that they also put their faith in God. It's an amazing thing. I don't profess to understand how all that works. So that they also put their trust and faith in God. And of course, you know, as you, if you grew up in a Christian home, you know that you had to come to a point, and maybe you're there now, where you're still in the process of making what you were taught your own. And I think Timothy had to do that same thing. Paul said, from a child, you'd known the Holy Scriptures, which are able to make you wise to salvation. And I've often said, I'm a Timothy. I can't look back to any great sin that I've committed and say, boy, God just pulled me out of the gutter, like some people, you know. And sometimes I've wished, I think I'm understanding where I've wished foolishly, but I've wished at times growing up that I could have some grand transformation. Then I'd know for sure that God saved me. I just kind of grew up believing the right things. And I was a good boy most of the time. But how can I come to experience the grace of God and really become, you know, people talk about being overwhelmed at how gracious God was for them. And they're just overwhelmed by the grace of God. Well, I'm so thankful I'm having more and more of those moments where I've been overwhelmed by God's grace in my life. Even though I grew up in a Christian home and was taught and came to the Lord 11, 12 years of age, didn't go out and party on the town, you know, as a young person. And yet I'm seeing more and more that I need God just as much. Just as much. It took just as much grace for me as it did for the guy who was a murderer and a whatever else you might want to catalog. Well, number two, so they will not forget God's acts or the keeping of his commands. So they will not forget. Notice how God all the time in the Old Testament was wanting them to put up some kind of monument. He wanted them to see and show their children. Don't stop telling your children. And have you ever noticed how that when God is rebuking Israel late in the Old Testament, train up a child, Proverbs says, in the way he should go. When he is old, he will not depart from it. Train here refers largely to example. Train up a child. Example. I know people who say that, you know, there's many a morning I got up and heard my dad praying or saw my dad reading his Bible. And you know what? I can't say that I saw that. But you know what? I do remember the two or three times that I did see him reading his Bible. Not that he only read it two or three times. I didn't see him very often. But you know, the times I did see him, somehow those stick. It's amazing to me. Why is it that one or two time that I happen to see him, it's very clear in my mind. Training refers to example. I also remember the time that we were out of the community and my dad had a talk in church, and I walked past the study door and I heard my dad praying in there. It's the only time I ever heard him praying when he was in private. But I remember that time. I remember it. And our children, whether you're a teacher or a parent, I believe need to see that you're for real. That you're serious about what you say you believe, that it affects the way you live. Otherwise, it becomes a stench.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.